From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with author Caitlin Hamilton Summey, whose new book is Geographies of the Heart, published by Burlington's own Fomite Press. Caitlin Hamilton Summey earned an MFA with distinction from Colorado State University, and her short stories have been published in Beloit Fiction Journal, Wisconsin Review, Puerto de Sol, Mud Season Review, Long Story Short, and elsewhere. Her first book, an award-winning short story collection called To Lay to Rest Our Ghosts, was released in August 2017 by Fomite. Her first novel, Geographies of the Heart, is out now. She spent many years in Massachusetts, Minnesota, and Colorado before settling with her family in Knoxville, Tennessee. She co-owns the book marketing firm Caitlin Hamilton Marketing and Publicity, founded in 2003. Here's a little information about Geographies of the Heart, her new novel. Sarah McMillan always puts her family first, but as she ages, she can't quite stretch her arms wide enough to hold on to everyone. Her career-minded and inattentive younger sister, Glennie, their grandparents who are slowly fading, or the late-in-life pregnancy Sarah desperately wanted. But it's her tumultuous relationship with Glennie that makes Sarah the loneliest. She'd always believed that their relationship was foundational, even unbreakable. Though blessed with a happy marriage to Al, whose compassion and humor she admires, Sarah grows increasingly bitter about Glennie's absences until one decision forces them all to decide what family means and who family is. So my interview with Caitlin Hamilton Summey begins with me asking my first question. I hope you enjoy our conversation. The novel comes on the heels, or is a follow-on, sort of, to your collection, To Lay to Rest Our Ghosts. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about finding and developing your point of view characters and maybe reimagining them in this new novel, like if that was a project for you, or if you already sort of had a very full vision of who they were as you went in.
I think the way to answer that question is to let you know that I spent 25 years on the story collection.
I saw that in your, yeah.
Yeah, I'm a mom. I'm a working mom. And so I have to write in the 5 minutes I get. There were whole years I didn't write. But I have been writing about Sarah McMillan. And this is where it gets a little murky because I don't remember. But I believe I started writing about her in 1994.
Wow.
The first story I wrote about Sarah was chapter 2 in the novel called Cleaning House. The chapter 2 is called Cleaning House. The novel isn't called Cleaning House. And then I just kept writing about them as a family. The three strongest stories ended up in the collection. And then I knew I had other stories. And I thought, well, let's try and pull a novel together. I first tried in 2010. Which I didn't remember. Didn't remember I'd put the stories into a novel until I opened it up again in about 2018. Wow. And I thought, oh, this is fabulous. Apparently I've already started, you know? Yeah. Yay me. So I guess I have lived with and written about Sarah for half my life.
Wow, that's amazing.
And I wanted to finish her story.
Yeah.
I wanted to set her free.
Wonderful. Now, you do have three point of view characters, and I myself am a writer, and I've written in multiple points of view, and I love it. But I want to know, you know, how was it for you writing with multiple points of view? And also, you change person for your chapters, and I'm trying to remember, but I don't think that you are necessarily always in the third person for one character. Sometimes that person gets a first person point of view and sometimes not. So that was interesting too. So just maybe talk about, you know, these craft decisions and how it was to work with them.
I'm a really intuitive writer. And I think Sarah is a good person. Sarah shoulders a great deal of caregiving, largely alone. At the same time, she's managing loss and trying to earn money because she doesn't have a job. And at the same time, she has her first child. And I think that Sarah dips into some real bitter years and gets resentful because she's overwhelmed for years. And then she learns to pull herself out. And I think she's a wonderful person, but there are some stories where she isn't a wonderful person. And isn't that all of us sometimes? So I felt intuitively that I needed to have Al in there, that I needed to have a counterpoint and somebody to lend perspective, because he loves unconditionally, for better or worse. But I also felt really drawn at one point. I remember in 2009, I remember the evening sitting at the kitchen table, and I heard a line, because that's how I write. And I started writing, and it was Al. And so it's a mix of knowing what's right and feeling what's right. Intellectually, as I put everything together toward the end, I knew that Glennie needed to have a say. I think she's the most complicated person. I think she is, in some ways, the strongest person. Her kindnesses are never known because she never speaks about them. She does not trumpet her own horn in any way. And so I think had she not had a voice, she would have been really one-dimensional. And I needed to say, hey, this is me. This is Glennie. I know I'm not perfect, but look at these good things I've done and look how hard I try. Mm-hmm. So that was an intellectual decision. The others were partly emotional.
Okay.
Just intuitive.
Right. Wonderful. Now, you've just mentioned Glennie, who is Sarah's mm-hmm. sister, and that actually leads nicely into another question. This isn't specifically about Glennie. Do you mind if I read a quick paragraph?
Please. Okay. I'm honored.
Great. So this is from Sarah's point of view, I'm pretty sure. Glennie had always been tiny, delicate, like a willow branch, all legs, long golden hair and blue eyes, beautiful, intense, a reed of a girl who had no interest in her own looks and often seemed perplexed that others did. But she looked rail thin now. And it goes on from there. And I actually, that really struck me. I loved that description of her, and I hadn't pictured her before that point. So I wanted to talk a little bit about describing characters. Not all authors feel like they need to describe characters. So I wondered, for you, who do you need to describe and in what depth?
I think one of the underlying themes in this novel, once I put it all together, was body image and issues with weight and control issues with food. So I'm not a big describer of characters, I realized, but it was critical to describe Glennie. And in that first chapter, having already mentioned what Sarah and Al look like a little bit in their first date, because body image and control matters so much to Glennie and become a recurring issue between these two sisters, I felt like I needed at that point to introduce her looks, to introduce that thread, because going forward into the next stories, it would be this recurring point of simmering tension.
Okay.
And so I don't describe people a lot, but I knew that I needed to at that point with Glennie, not right away, but then.
Great. All right. I like that, because it's not just formulaic. It's very much specific and situational and yeah.
It is. I mean, it's the first, it has to make sense, doesn't it? And that's the first time Sarah really looks at her sister. You know, earlier on when she's describing herself for the date, of course she is. She's wondering how she looks. She's seeing Al, and she's sort of evaluating how he looks. Is she attracted to him physically? So those seem to me natural. But when she's talking to her sister on the phone about the date later, things like that, she wouldn't think how Glennie looks.
Mm-hmm.
But when Glennie comes in at the end of that chapter and she turns and she sees her, she knows there is a reason to be concerned. And that at that point is when it makes sense to say, this is my sister and she's not well. And I can see it in her body frame.
Yeah. All right. I have a question about something that you do. I have a feeling it's part of your style and I enjoyed it, but I did notice it. So you have this way of telling a story where you sort of get us into one of the storylines, but then you kind of flash forward and share the story retroactively. Is that the right word? You introduce the story and then all of a sudden we are really deep into it and we get the background in between those two points then. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do.
Yeah. And it's interesting.
I've always done this and I don't know why. I think it might be how I think. In the story Cleaning House, it begins with Sarah in the nursing home hallway, afraid to go into her grandparents' room. And she doesn't know why they've been arguing, but she knows it relates to her. In that specific story, I felt like I had to pull back and explain honestly how the grandparents had ended up there. I think maybe otherwise a reader would feel like, of course, elderly people are in a nursing home, but that's not what this family lived like. That's not who this family was. And it was the appropriate time to explain that it was a multi-generational family. But it was, again, an intuitive decision to pull back and look back and explain the trauma of their changing homes. The strength of their relationship, I think, comes through then, too. And then to go forward, I think, with the rest of the story, would help people understand she was walking through chasms of grief. And to know that now there was a problem that she had apparently caused really caused her alarm. So that pullback was both intuitive, I suppose, and on some level planned. But that is just how I think, I guess. It's just, it is there. I do it. I don't know why.
No, it's great. Like, you know, at the beginning, and I think I've got this question buried later. But there's, you know, at the beginning, she goes on a date with Al. She meets Al. She goes on a date with Al. And then there comes a point, you know, a new chapter comes at a certain point. We don't know whether things with Al worked out or not. But all of a sudden, he's upstairs snoring. And you're like, okay, so that worked out. Which was kind of fun.
I think it's fun. And I think, honestly, some readers will probably want something a little bit more A, B, C, D, E, F. I simply don't write that way. Andrew Krivak is somebody I reached out to for a blurb. I don't know him personally, but I really hoped he'd blurb me and he did. And I just fell over. I was so proud, but he said something that I've never thought of. And I think is true. He said, I write like waves cross oceans.
Oh, wow.
And I think it makes sense because in all my stories, I think I very much follow that arc of, you know, introducing things, rising action, climax, falling action, resolution. But I think in this novel, I do write like waves and they do build and they do finally crash. But there's a lot of pushing forward, pulling back. There's a lot of silt that gets pulled up and then it settles and then it comes back up because somebody in the family had to mention something. And so it all comes swirling back up in another wave. And so I think that that's true to this story. I think that I do write like waves. I pull threads in when I want them.
That's a lovely image. Wow. What a nice blurb.
It's his, you know, and I fell over that he even did it, but I felt so proud. But then as I sat and thought about it, I thought, my gosh, he's right. He's illuminated my own work for me. Yeah. So yes, I don't just spell out they got back together or they fell apart or they loved each other or they didn't. I pull it through when I want it.
I think this is related, but I'm just going to mention two more examples, if I may, because sometimes you alert us In my question, I said you have for Sarah and Al alerted us to coming hallmarks of their relationship, and this was interesting too. So this is, I think this might still be on the date. She remembered this moment all her life, the first time they argued, the first time she wanted to jut her chin out, the first time she was scared of losing him, and so scared at being scared that for a moment she didn't answer but looked around his office, which she'd never seen before, at the pictures of Jesus clustered above a desk. Okay, so that's not their first date. It's a little later. And then there's another one. Sarah learned the technique from him, she thought, later, the long listening and the respectful quiet, and then slowly her response. So first of all, I loved how that gives us some character descriptions of him, who he is and how he puts himself out in the world. But it's also, it's interesting that in each moment, it's like, this is what this will mean to her later. Mm-hmm. And I think that's sort of like those waves also on a smaller scale.
I think it is. And I think it doesn't say necessarily what their future held, simply the impact of the relationship.
Right.
And at that point, a reader can intuit what they will. But I think it shows, as you say, who Al is in the world.
Yes.
And the impact he has, which Al would never credit himself for having.
Right, right. Let's see. All right. So the time period for this novel is 90s and early aughts, as people say.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if we can talk a little bit about that choice of time period, which may just be because that's when you started writing about them. I don't know. And mm-hmm. also your use of narrative time. And again, there's a back and forth there with narrative mm-hmm. time as well.
It does go forward a little bit later.
It does. Yeah, it does.
It ends later.
Yes.
Again, that was sort of an intuitive decision. I'm writing about a lot of different things, and you can't tell certain parts of their family life if you don't go forward.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted, as much as this novel is Sarah's and about her family, it's also about sisters. And so to me, to finish the story of sisters in this generational story, I needed to get to the next generation, because I refer to the generation before Sarah's, the trouble she has with her grandmother and her grandmother's sister. Sarah and Glennie are in conflict. And I needed to get to the next generation personally. I wanted people to see how that transpired. And I think the way I do that is by leaping forward when I do. But I think it's also sort of like what you said, where I write in first person, I write in third person. I actually even write in second person at the end. And I think part of it comes back to that intuitive telling, where I know I need to go a certain way, so I have to go so far. And I know in certain stories that what I hear is third person, but I also know sometimes I'm hearing first person, and I go with it, because I think that sometimes you need to be really close to material, and you need to have that first person heart. But other times you need the distance, because there is loss and change in this book that's hard to take. And it's better to step back a little bit into third.
Mm-hmm.
So the time and the use of point of view are, again, that mix of thinking through how I want to get there and what's the best way to tell a very emotional story.
Mm-hmm.
But then also I just hear it. I mean, this is, I know you've heard this from other authors. It's just what I hear.
Mm-hmm.
And I trust that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 53 now, and I've learned to trust what I hear.
Yeah. It's interesting, because I feel like that makes a better narrative for a reader, to trust what you're hearing, to go with intuition, not to, for example, and I don't mean to say that it's wrong to have an outline. There are some people that do that incredibly well. Anne Patchett writes from an outline. I was shocked when I heard that, because her work seems very intuitive in a lot of ways. But I think that you kind of carry a reader along with you in a sort of emotional discovery if mm-hmm. you're more intuitive, although it will take 25 years.
Yes, and this one took even longer, you know. I think when I come to, I have to trust the intuition. But then there, when I go back and rewrite, is often when the thought comes more into play. And when I get some feedback, you know, Mark Estrin at Fomite Press, I just have to give him a shout out. Really worked hard with me on the opening of this book, because I had been writing it for decades and I really saw the characters a certain way. And it took me a while. You know, I had it all. I'd done my intuitive thing, but he kept trying to tell me really gently, no. And when I finally got where he wanted me to go, or at least close to where he wanted me to go, I realized I'd never done them justice, that the opening needed to change to give them greater dignity. And so that's where I think the thinking comes most into play, where I'm rewriting, where I'm having to think, where I'm being asked to think. And Mark was right. I don't think, had my novel begun as I originally thought it should, that anyone would have credited Sarah and Al with what they were able to manage in subsequent stories. I think they would have seemed too flighty and immature. So thank you, Mark.
That's great.
It took 6.5 months
for him
that
to
opening
for you him to rewrite.
Yeah, for him to accept my rewrite. I rewrote it for 6.5 months.
Wow. That's a credit to you too, though, because that's hard. That's really
it is hard.
Yeah.
I couldn't see it. It started at a party. I'll just say that. And so for a long time, I just kept moving the party to different locations. You know.
They're in the Hamptons.
Yeah, he's like, stop with the party. Give them a different opening date. And so I thought, oh, okay. But I mean, really, poor Margaret, I don't know how many party drafts. By the time I got them to the coffee date that opens the novel, I think he and I were both exhausted. But, you know, he stuck with me.
Yeah.
And I got the opening I wanted and an opening, you know, that he wanted. And I gave my characters greater dignity. And it took forever. But what's 6.5 months when you've been writing it for decades, right?
Right, so. Right. By then, you've pretty much proven to yourself that you're in it for the long haul.
I just want it done before I die, you know?
Well, that's a good segue to my next question. So I wanted to talk a little bit about writing, about universally difficult things like aging, dying, difficult love. These are hard subjects, and I would think maybe a little hard to immerse yourself in. As you're working. And I don't mean to say that this novel doesn't have its light, joyful moments, but there are some pretty serious themes in here. So can you talk a little bit about writing those themes?
Sure. I think the novel is intense. It's why I tried to lace the novel with humor. And there is a lot of humor in the novel. But I think these are the themes I think about. These are the things that are somewhat on my mind. This is fiction. I don't know Sarah. I don't have a sister. But I did grow up in a multi-generational family. And I think when you do, or at least for me, I should say, I shouldn't make that a generalization. For me, I spent a lot of time in my childhood worrying about whether or not people would be there in the morning. And I think I understand the fear of loss, and I understand the importance of family. I understand some of the details that go into caregiving, although I was in no way ever my grandparents' caregiver. So, I mean, these are things that I know and think about and care about. My family's really close and happy. We didn't have all this strife, but strife is also easier to write about. And so I think that when you're addressing themes like this, it's easier for the sad parts to become more prominent. I also think that writing over these decades, when I thought I was just writing stories, you choose a conflict in a story, And then when you shape them into chapters and you put them in a line, it becomes a different kind of narrative. So while one story might be intense, putting the string together into the bracelet, so to speak, it was clear that there were a lot of intense moments for Sarah, lots of things she really had to grapple with. And that's just the way it was, given the structure, given how I'd put these stories out there, you know? So then the humor became more important. The compassion became more important. The forgiveness became exceedingly important. You know, you cannot hit a reader over the head with heavy thing after heavy thing. There has to be a shared joke, funny theme. Even in the worst of moments, there has to be a joke. And I think it's our time as writers and readers to be compassionate.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me that you don't have a sister, because that was one of my questions. Sisterhood is a big theme in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And that theme is introduced early on, because we know that Sarah has a sister, Glennie, who we've already mentioned. But then later, there's this wonderful moment of intrigue where the very first time we hear about the grandmother's sister is the name Cecily, whose name had long ago been erased from the family tree. And so first of all, as a reader, I was like, oh, that's interesting. What happened there? So there's like this wonderful kind of intrigue. So I'm curious about maybe the idea of building tension into a literary family narrative, which I think isn't necessarily always associated with suspense necessarily. But that was a really intriguing moment. And I liked that as a reader, but also to talk about sisters as a theme and why you were drawn to that.
I think that building tension comes primarily in terms of Sarah for me. Will she be able to manage? Mm-hmm. You have to care about Sarah. And so if you care about Sarah, and I hope readers will, then the tension is, can she manage this? Can she manage that? What choice will she make when she's given choices? And I think the wonderful thing about Sarah is that she is as hard as on herself as she is on other people. She's not sitting there shaking her finger at other people. So I think the tension comes from watching Sarah, but then also watching some of these other characters, like who is Cecily? What's going to happen to her? Is Al going to do this? Is Glennie going to do X, Y, and Z? Mm-hmm. They make a huge decision, Sarah and Al, at a certain point. And so one, you don't know at that point how the family will respond. So the tension comes from caring about them and caring about their choices. As for writing about sisters, Glennie just appeared. And so I kept going with her. And I realized that Sarah is dedicated to her family and Glennie is dedicated to her career.
Mm-hmm.
And the tension mounts as they age, as people become ill, as they have to manage family situations, they have to confront their differing priorities. And I think there's great tension there. You know, Sarah has her own issues to deal with and face, but underlying all this is, will she remain alone or will Glennie step up? Because their differing perspectives on family and what family requires is part of Sarah's set of worries. And so I think there is sort of underlying tensions that sort of intertwine and braid together as these women decide who they are and what family means. I mean, the ultimate question is, will this family survive as a family,
mm-hmm.
as a multi-generational loving family?
Mm-hmm. So at one point, her grandmother actually yells at her, "You cannot write what you want. It's not just your story." That was a really interesting statement, just from the perspective of writers, and a lot of the listeners of this show are writers, because we struggle with what is ours to share and what is not ours to share necessarily, and should we change things enough that it won't be recognizable when we share it. So just as far as that goes, writing other people's stories, and I don't know if some of your own background was part of this. It sounds like it definitely informed it. But what would you say about that?
First of all, when Sarah's writing that family history and her grandmother has issues with it, I think it brings to the fore that people have different perspectives, even in family, and we have to respect differences, even if we don't agree with them. And in terms of being a writer, my growing up in a multi-generational family absolutely informed this, but this isn't my family. And mm-hmm. what I find interesting is when something comes in that is true, when I'm writing along, there's a line in this novel that just came in when the grandfather is speaking, and it's something my grandfather used to say. I didn't plan it. It just popped up, and it served its purpose. It needed to be there. My grandfather was a wonderful man. He's not this man, but he did serve in World War I and World War II. He was on a ship outside Vladivostok and believes he saw the beginning of the Russian Revolution. Again, that came into the novel, just sort of into that story, because I heard it and I wrote it. But I think it was easy for me to dissociate from my own experience, other than these lines, because I'm not writing my story. I don't have a sister. I never had a contentious relationship with my grandmother. I never had to caregive. I mean, so many things. I don't sew. I don't sew at all. But I think what matters to me, and I've talked a little bit about this in the past with the stories, is what matters to me is if it's emotionally true. If it's emotionally true, if I can feel that this is how I feel in this situation, if it feels honest to what the characters would feel in that situation, then I think for me as a writer and reader, that's what matters. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what matters to readers. A character they can care about, notes that don't sound false. For those writers who are writing closer to the bone, who are telling stories more explicitly, directly their experience, I feel great compassion toward. I don't know how I would handle that. I think it would be very difficult to know what to share and what not to share, and how to protect those one cares about or feels the need to protect. I had great freedom here, but I did say at the end of my story collection, and I made sure to say early on in this interview, that this isn't my family and we're all very happy and close.
Yeah.
because I think readers often assume, because we all grew up in fourth grade hearing write what you know,
right?
They assume this is my family, you know, and it's not. It's not. There are aspects of my family, though, that are certainly here. And I'm sure there are things in this story I've revealed about us all that I don't even know.
Yeah. Okay. Wonderful. This is a tiny point, but it's interesting to me because I've tried this and decided whether or not to do it before. You titled your chapters, right?
Mm-hmm.
You titled your chapters. You've already mentioned one or two of the titles. One of them that I loved was About Amelia, for Amelia, who is asking about herself. That was a great title. So what do you think that brings to the book, to title the chapters?
I felt like it provided a path. This is a novel told over a great span of time by three narrators with varying points of view, as I said, first, third, and second. There are sometimes big gaps in time.
Right.
And I don't lead with, as you said, all of a sudden Al pops up and you didn't even quite know that he was back, right? So I felt like I felt like the chapter titles were the signposts that I don't give in my prose. This is Sarah talking about Amelia. This is Al, and it's going to be something about roots, and it's not going to be gardening. This is, you know, and I think it serves that purpose. And I really did play with form in this novel, but I, as a reader, would want some map. And I think this is a good map, because how I write is how I write. But I do want people to want to go on.
Uh-huh. Okay, wonderful. This is changing direction a little bit. I always like to ask my guests what they've read lately that they would recommend.
I have read The Tuscan Child, which I think is literary and commercial in a blend. And I'm not sure, I think it's Reese Bowen. I don't know that I'm pronouncing her first name correctly. But what I loved about this book was she writes beautifully. But she also plots beautifully. And she has a couple of twists. And so it's that perfect blend of the literary and the commercial. And then the other thing I really enjoyed reading was I had read a mystery called The Thursday Morning Murder Club, which probably everybody's heard about because it's a huge bestseller. So I read the sequel, which I think is even better. This was my vacation read over the holidays. And I learned, I laughed out loud 3 times. And it felt so good to laugh. And I learned some interesting things, I suppose, if I really had to study this. But I do think he's really wonderful with his characterizations, not just his humor. It's, of course, as a mystery, very deftly plotted. But what he does with his people as characters. I mean, I just want to go have lunch with them all. I want to join the club, you know? And I think when you have that kind of response from a reader, you've won.
Yeah.
Regardless of genre. You know, if people care that much, you've won.
Okay, great. Now, you worked, and actually I have another question about the length of time it took you to work on this, so we're not going to settle there. But I am curious what you're writing next, and is it interesting to you to come up with something next, or are we going to study this family a little more?
Well, that's an interesting question. I am in the middle of, I just actually wrote an essay about this. It's called Empty Next Syndrome.
Because
I'm done now with the Macmillan family. They've left the nest. And I am sitting in a really fallow period and I'm enjoying it. There are things in my house that I haven't done for decades, you know, painting, but truly. I'm just enjoying being a person in the world with a quieter mind because I'm not hearing voices from the Macmillans. They're on their way. And I hope that they'll be well received and loved. I have a middle grade novel that I've been working on for 11 years, which will shock you, not at all. I may pull that back out, rewrite it and try and submit it. I have a completed edited children's picture book that I may try and find a home for. But as for something new, there's nothing. I don't know if there will be. But I'll wait to hear.
Okay.
I'll listen for that line.
I suspect there will be, but that's just me. I have a question about your work as a publicist.
Yes.
Now, I know you from before this interview and book because we have worked together in your capacity as a publicist. So I want to talk about how you came into that work. But I'm also curious about how it affected your writing of a very literary book. And if the press of commercial potential is, you know, in one ear, while the dream and intuition of what you're working on is in the other ear, or if that wasn't an issue for you, if that it makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. So let me start with the first part of that question, how I became a book publicist in 1996. I had just finished my MFA at Colorado State and was looking for work. I couldn't find work for about a year and was temping. I thought I might try something like social work. But I received an opportunity to apply for a job in Boulder. And it was at a university press that was excellent. I'm a Middle Eastern history major, and I would have gotten to work in the history department. But unfortunately, at that time, university presses paid so little that I literally couldn't have afforded the gas if I could have found the car, or I could have bought the car and never found the gas to get there. And that's how I declined him. I said, I would love to work with you, but if I get the car, I can't afford the gas on the salary. I don't know how to get from where you are to where I am. So
were you in Denver?
I was in Fort Collins and they were in Boulder.
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah.
And then it turned out that Fred Ramey at McMurray and Back, which was a wonderful small press that launched Susan Vreeland and Steve Yarbrough, William Gay, heard that I was looking, and he reached out to me to be his marketing director. And
wow.
I said to him, I don't want to waste your time. I have never worked in marketing. And he said, let's have a talk anyway. Anyway, I ended up with the job. It was between me and this other guy. And I came home and I called one of my dearest friends and I said, you took marketing, right? She said, yes. I said, I need your marketing 101 textbook now. I had to look up what marketing was. So I learned on my feet. And actually, I think it was probably the best way to go. Because I think for all the things that I had to figure out that were really hard and challenging, I think when you're fighting that hard and you're on, in the trenches with small presses and you're on your feet, you learn some things that coming up through the ranks, you might not have learned. And some of it's about personal relationships, mistakes you make, mistakes you don't make, pulling your team together, things like that. So I've been a book publicist proudly since 1996. How does this affect me as a writer? It's really interesting. I think it makes me more compassionate. Mm. I've spent 20 years telling people it's okay if they get a bad review or if somebody didn't assign their book. So having been on the other side of the desk, I know what to tell myself if I have a disappointment. And then at the same time, it's hard because I'm still a writer and I have all the same feelings you all have as writers, you know. And so I guess what I try to do is tell myself in a disappointing instance, because there have been, what I would tell any other of my writers, but then also allow myself to feel what I feel, because I'm a person too, and mm-hmm. I'm a writer too.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the commerciality of my book, I would say that I am pretty clear about where I stand. I know my writers can sometimes have more commercial books, and that is their truth, and that is their story. And I celebrate that. Mine is literary. I will have readers and I will have readers who don't care for it. And that's my truth and my story. I think if the readers who are my readers care about my people, I've won. If they feel that I've done a job well, I've won. If they see merit in it, I've won. Of course, I hope that the book is well received and does well. I don't think being a literary writer and a small press writer means we just throw up our hands and say, there's only so much response we can get.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something you learn in the trenches, I think. If your book is worthy, you fight for it till the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I do that for me, and I do that for my clients. I should say at this point that my publicist actually is my husband and business partner, Rick. So the credit for the success of the collection and of the novel is really his, although I do step in and I do make some outreach, of course. I do fight for my book, you know, but largely the credit for any success is to Rick.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, that's great. I just have one last question. The book took 25 plus years to write.
Yes, forever.
And so I always like to ask for advice for listeners who are writers. And I've taken decades on projects before, and I know how that goes. You know, it's about the love of writing. It's about the project and wanting it to be the best that it can be. And it's about the love of what you're doing. But it's also a little frustrating sometimes that it's, you know, you look at the clock or you look at the calendar. So I wonder if you have advice for people who are working on a book over time.
I think what I would say is to be kind to yourself. It can be, and also at the same time, to be a good literary citizen. The motto here at this company for book publicity is clients first. That's just the way it is. And I have two kids and decided during the pandemic to get a puppy. I mean, this was not well thought out, two teenagers and a puppy at the same time. But I was kind to myself and I knew I needed to take the time and at the same time be a good literary citizen and put my work first and support my friends who were publishing and understand and accept that I was going to take some time. So, you know, I think it's those three things: be kind to yourself, be a good literary citizen, and accept your process.
Mm-hmm.
And trust that process. Don't rush a book to print. There's no point in getting, I can tell you this as a publicist, there is no point in rushing and not having a book, not in this marketplace especially. It's the hardest I've seen in 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's the toughest, it's the unkindest. There is no point in rushing. Get the best book you can and then bring it to market. Doesn't mean you can't think about publicity or even, I told one lady to get a notebook and jot down all the things that she heard about that were interesting that her writer friends were doing, podcasts, anything. Be, you know, ideas. If you have an elevator pitch, scribble it down, but don't live there. Book first, finish your book, then pull out that notebook, you know, as you start your agent queries or whatever you're going to do. Everything in its time. Everything in its time.
Fantastic. Okay, wonderful. I wanted to just mention again, the name of the book is Geographies of the Heart, a novel by Caitlin Hamilton Summey. The book is published by Fomite Press. And Caitlin, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you. I had a blast. Thank you so much.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Caitlin Hamilton Summey. You can learn more about her writing at CaitlinHamiltonSummey.com and about her work in publicity at CaitlinHamiltonMarketing.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by my guest, Caitlin Hamilton Summey. Consider the following prompt as an opening or a reflection or in whatever way it might help you with your writing. I didn't want to steal it, but I did. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Okay, a reminder to listeners who write, I do share a writing prompt each week. Be sure to check the archives of Write the Book if you would like to find any that you might have missed. Usually my guests suggest them, sometimes I come up with them. I would love your feedback about Write the Book. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors, if you've heard of new books that are out and you want to see if I can talk to the people who wrote them, or if you have events that you need to announce. As I said before, I try to fit those in when there's time. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We are also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook and all the different social media sites, and you can access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it where you find it and like it on social media and talk about it. Tell your friends. Okay, up next in just a few minutes, stay tuned for Feminist Frenzy, the radio show with a feminist agenda. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.